All right, and our guest is Ryan Wood. We're talking about his work, incredible work, where he has been chasing down 74 crashed UFO cases, and he put them all together in this document, this book called Magic Eyes Only. We'll be back in a moment with your phone calls, and we'll further our chat with Ryan Wood right here on Coast to Coast AM. Ryan, tell me about the Cape Girardeau, Missouri case, 1941. What have you uncovered there?
Well, this goes back to Leonard Stringfield, who originally published the Charlotte Mann story, who's the granddaughter of Reverend Huffman. And Reverend Huffman was a Baptist minister living in Cape Girardeau in 1941, and he was asked to come to the scene of an airplane crash, but when he got there, it was not an airplane crash, but a crashed saucer, sort of more of an acorn-like shape, more like Kecksburg, that was broken open and had two ET bodies in one area and one set off to the other side, hieroglyphic markings inside the craft and a burned area. And he was asked to give blessings to the ETs, and he did that. And then the military came and swore everybody to secrecy and carted everything off. But there was quite a number of witnesses there. So we have documents that talk about a crash. Some of the Leak Majestic documents talk about a crash in Missouri in 1941. We have the testimony of Charlotte Mann, who's the granddaughter of Reverend Huffman, given to her on a deathbed confession of Reverend Huffman's wife, Flo Huffman. And that forms sort of the kernel of believability. And then you have some second-tier witnesses, the brother of the sheriff, Clarence Shady, remembers a story like this, and there's a couple other people that are alive today that remember, you know, rumors like this. You know, I would not give them high credibility, but they remember stories like this back in the 40 time frame or 41.
And you know, as I was mentioning, I'd go to Cape Girardeau for my son's college. I mean, is it specific enough to know where this thing crashed?
Well, that's a good question, and the answer is sort of. We know that Reverend Huffman was driven 15 minutes, 20 minutes outside of town, and he had gone west. If you go east, you go across the Mississippi, and there's a limited number of roads. We know that he went in like a quarter of a mile off the road. So it's a bounded problem. I have looked at I've used dowsers, I've used intuitives, I've looked at historical aerial photography. The whole place was overflown in 1941 in October with 9-inch stereo negatives that you could pour through. So if I had like a couple weeks and $4,000 or $5,000, I could get all the
You'd get close,
stereos huh? blown up and get real serious and real accurate about finding this scar in the earth and the area, the exact location. And then once you have the exact location, it's game over. It's time to go in and look with the metal detectors and find evidence that I think is still there, because they, you know, by Roswell time, I think they had gotten their act together.
Well, you know, because of the significance of the alleged crash, you would think the area would have been scoured by now, and it really hasn't.
No, and I think that's the case with a lot of crashes. That it's one thing to, you're assigned this task of clean up the area, spend a couple days at it, and look around and make sure you get everything. But you know how these archaeologists work nowadays. They grid off everything and dig down the next meter. And they sift through every single thing to try to find a shard. And I think there's loads of shards left at a lot of these crash sites. And for the military to clandestinely try to go back and do a full-on next-level archaeological scouring is just not feasible and would simply draw a lot of attention.
To the phones we go. Let's pick it up by going to our first-time caller line. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi.
Hi, George. My name is Ryan. I'm from South Bend, Indiana.
Hi, Ryan. Thanks for calling.
George, I'd like to thank you, first of all, for being brave enough to release a lot of this information that you do. It's really courageous of you. And, Ryan, the question that I pose to you is, you said there's been 74 extraterrestrial crash landings, which indicates to me that there would have been thousands, possibly millions of visitations over the course of the last thousands of years. Do you think, out of any of these visits, there's been a lot of civilizations with unexplained structures? Do you believe that at any time we've received any extraterrestrial technology?
Have we received extraterrestrial technology directly as a gift handed on the table? I think that's possible, but it's deep in the speculation of the field right now. I think that we've gotten a lot of technology just by recovering the wreckages and analyzing it and trying to reverse engineer it. You know, is the laser or is fiber optics or is night vision goggles or the integrated circuit linked back to extraterrestrial hardware? And I think the answer is it very likely could be, but the research to prove it really hasn't been done.
Okay.
Okay, well, thanks a lot for your time.
Okay.
You know, Area 51. An area that, of course, continues to reach our mysteries of our minds. Do you believe they're still conducting some kind of UFO research there, or have they, as some people have speculated now, Ryan, transferred this to other regions of the country?
Well, I think that, you know, once you have a good facility for doing ET research, you're not going to give it up. It's a nice, secure location. The answer is, yeah, I think they're doing some level of work there. But I also believe that White Sands Proving Grounds is another location where there's all sorts of active military operations, reverse engineering ET hardware in deep underground bases, and operating you know, Mach 10 Earth-to-orbit or Earth-to-planet vehicles.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because tomorrow night Linda Moulton Howe is going to give us a report about White Sands.
Yeah, I've got a special project that I'm working on. One of the leaked photographs that came with the Majestic documents was a picture of White Sands with a big black X in the upper corner, and it said Area 29. It gave no explanation other than just this big block X and Area 29. And when I start going through the aerial photography that you can get on Terra Server or any of the other official servers, you find all sorts of interesting, anomalous structures. I actually found, oddly enough, a line of like 20 semi-tractor trailers snaking down a road going directly into the side of a mountain.
20.
It was shocking. It was like, what? Didn't they understand that somebody's overhead satellites are going around? And it was just surprising, you know, all spaced out. And I've done remote viewing projects on, you know, what's going on there, and looked around, and there's lots of double fenced off structures that are 2 miles wide, in a circle or sort of an octagon. There's some what looks like a target, where you have a plus sign and then a series of circles surrounding it that go out like 2 miles. And you look at these structures and you say, what is this? Now, is it some sort of communications technology? There's lots of weird things going on White Sands, and it's one of our biggest bases. I think it is the biggest base in the United States.
Yeah, I'm going to look forward to chatting with Linda about that. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello, my name is Tim from West Michigan.
Hi there, Tim. Go ahead.
Yeah, I have a first-time revealed family secret. When my mother passed away, we found some photographs and a letter from my uncle, who was, our family believes, shot down over Nagasaki back in the early 40s in a B-29 Super Fortress. And the pictures were of quite old and of some alien figures. The letter was an admission that my uncle never was shot down, that he was working for the government. He went on to explain that he was hired by the government to kill a colonel. I don't know if I should say his name or not.
Well, go ahead.
His name was Albert Boss, and that he was the colonel who flew the bodies from Roswell up to a facility in the Midwest, Clark or Clark Edwards, but something like that. Even named the ammo, the type of rifle he used, and everything. He said he shot him in Grayling, Michigan, while the guy was deer hunting.
Because
he was about to reveal the secret about these alien bodies. And sure enough, my oldest brother and I, my dad's just about ready to die. He'll kill me if I tell anybody any of this, but I'm telling you guys now because he's on his deathbed. We gave the photos, and anyway, we checked this out. And sure enough, there's an unsolved murder of this guy named Al Boss, who was a colonel in the United States Air Force up in Grayling, Michigan.
And how did he spell his last name?
I guess it was just B-O-S-S.
Al Boss. Okay, Grayling, Michigan.
Probably Albert Boss. And, well, that's fascinating.
What about these pictures?
Yeah, okay, so we confronted my father, who was ailing ill right now. And he demanded, it was his brother, apparently. So anyway, we gave him the photos and the letter. I asked him for an explanation, and he is yet to give them back. Now, the lady who cares for him right now is telling us that he burned all that evidence because he will not disgrace his brother's name.
The brother's being was the shooter?
His brother was the shooter, and his name is Clarence. I can give you more details off the air. I won't do it over the air.
No, I don't blame you. I'd love for you to stay in touch with us if I can put you on hold when we're done with this call with you. Maybe we can exchange numbers or something.
No problem.
That'd be great. Or send me an email from my website, you know.
Yeah, let me do that because, to be quite honest with you gentlemen, I'm at work, and I got to get back to work here. But first, very quickly, my heart and prayer goes out to those miners and their families, and so I just want to get that in.
Okay, we're going to put you on hold, and you can get to Tom the information, and we will stay in touch with each other. You know, if he sounds legitimate to me, Ryan, doesn't he?
Yeah, exactly. These are wonderful stories, and I applaud him for having the courage to come forward. I think there are hundreds of these situations that people just need a little encouragement. They feel a little remorse or shame about what's occurred, and they need to clear their conscience before they die, and they end up telling the truth. And their evidence and documents and information is oh so valuable to uncovering the truth.
We've got to do a Google search for an Albert Boss Grayling and find out if there's a story there.
Well, I'm sure that it's probably not in
pretty
the electronic
old
form.
No, it's probably very old. You got to go in there and do it by hand.
Right, and I have a long list. I mean, I gave a talk at the second annual UFO Crash Retrieval Conference on murders and Majestic 12, and I have a database of about 50 suspicious murders that I think are linked, and I would love to dig a little more and add this to the list.
Just keeps it going, doesn't it?
Yep. And there's 10 or so that are really obvious.
I mean, let me tell you the authenticity of, because he's giving Tom all his information. Most people would have just hung up if they weren't real. He's staying on the line. And how many people would talk about their father who's ready to die in that kind of a fashion? I mean, you don't joke about stuff like that.
Exactly. It takes a lot of courage to do that.
Let's go to our international line. Welcome to Coast. Where are you calling from?
Oh, hi. This is Avi from Tel Aviv.
Oh, Avi, welcome to the program. Good to see you.
Well, thank you very much. And hello, Ryan.
Hello.
Good morning. I would just like to ask you a question. It may sound a little cynical, but I don't mean it to. I'm just curious why, with all the even remote viewers and all the advantages you've had to investigate and probe, that you've not been able to come up with any literal, tangible evidence once again. And I'll be listening on the radio. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a great question. And the question is the term literal, tangible evidence. And the answer is, if you consider parts of a crash saucer as literal, tangible evidence, which I do, the answer is we got it. In the case of the San Antonio 1945 case, Ramey Baca, a firsthand witness, has parts that he picked up personally when he was a young boy and has had it analyzed and is continuing his analysis. And he lives up in Washington. Linda Howe has got, you know, Art's parts from Roswell. Roger Lear, Dr. Roger Lear, famous for his abduction research, but also has a part of Roswell wreckage, allegedly, and it's been analyzed. Chuck Wade has dug up from the plains of St. Augustine parts, physical pieces of material that he believes came from the plains of St. Augustine crash in 47. And there are a couple more that have physical evidence. And really, the next book, if there's a next book for me in a couple of years.
How long did it take you to do this one?
Well, you know, probably about 9 months.
That's pretty fast.
It is pretty fast. But I, you know, I had help. You know, I could call Jim Mars and say, you know, Jim, I want you to write the chapter on.
Yeah, he's good. I've been doing this. I've had help on mine, and it's still not done yet. It's at the publishers now, but that took about 2 years.
Yeah, so I was pretty dedicated and focused at it. And the next sort of area for me is all going to be on parts, all going to be on physical evidence. But the challenge with that is that I can get the physical evidence, you know, you can get the researcher and the part, and then you get it in front of a good lab, and you really need to pay the lab, you know, their full fees to be very effective and very rigorous and stand by their work and not be bullied in any way, shape, or form by any fallout.
I got to tell you, the caller who was mentioning the murder in Grayling, Michigan, which I'm familiar with being from Michigan, it sounded as believable as anybody I've talked to on the air, Ryan.
Yeah, I love it, and it's great, and I can keep, you know, working on other murders and people.
Well, I'll make sure that Tom gets you some information that he's given us, and let's make sure we follow up with each other on this guy.
Yeah, okay.
All right, stay with us. We'll be back with final phone calls with you, Ryan Wood. And the rest of the calls, I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Well, are you ready for the free StreamLink weekend? Starts this Friday, runs through Sunday. It's all free for you. We want you to have an opportunity to look at it. StreamLink is a treasure trove for many Coast to Coast AM fans. It allows you to listen to and collect the last 3 months' worth of shows for just pennies a day. You can download and burn MP3s of any of the last 90 days of shows, so you can take Coast to Coast on the go and listen to it at your leisure on both CD and MP3 players. So mark your calendar for Friday the 20th. And go to coasttocoastam.com for further details on the free weekend. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Ryan Wood, our guest. Ryan, what's new on your plate in the future? What are you up to?
I'm working on another crash retrieval. And it's that's the thing that's been consuming me of late. And I really don't want to, I should have it all buttoned up, but...
In this country,
it's historical. It offers the Holy Grail, and that is not only a good location with a good track record, but physical evidence and parts, which I believe are at the site. And it's not even in my book. And that was one of the things that I discovered in, looking at these crash retrieval events, is that I missed a few.
How do you know there are parts at the site?
Well, I mean, I have a variety of intelligence sources, but I don't want to discuss it all. But there's indications. I'm hopeful that there are parts at the site. We'll find out, and I'll go, and I'll spring this on the world and the public here, probably at the next crash retrieval conference in November of 06. But it could be a really good one. Now, Linda Howe at the latest crash retrieval conference this last year talked about her new crash retrieval case.
That was the one in November, right?
Yeah, November, and yeah. She was talking about a case in Utah in 1953, and she's doing more research on that. It's a very interesting case where you have this gigantic triangular-shaped area that's like 2,000 feet on a side,
yeah.
And apparently something that big.
And they buried it.
Crashed and buried it.
Yeah.
And that's a fascinating case. And then here's an example of, that case is neutral in the authenticity ratings, sort of. But, if she works on it some more, she could easily find some physical evidence and bump it up and get more researchers involved and more physical evidence. And it could become, a very highly, even more credible case than many others.
You have dedicated this book to people who have lost their lives for the sake of UFO secrecy and investigations.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, I feel that in this is, amongst other things, one of the crimes against humanity is this whole notion that we can't handle it, and we have to keep it secret, and we're going to kill people to prevent it.
That's a good point.
And that's really just kind of stupid.
We, about an hour ago, were talking about that Brazilian case in Virginia.
Yeah.
Not Virginia, but Virginia.
Virginia.
Tell me about that one more time, then we'll go to calls and wrap things up.
Yeah, there's several people saw some girls, actually.
Is this the same case that's in your book?
Yes,
it's got to be. Okay.
Yeah, it is. Some small girls walking home saw an alien crouched against a garage repair shop, a car garage repair shop, and they described it as had bright red eyes, lidless eyes. It was very striking.
Propped up against
propped
the garage?
Up, crouched in sort of a nook, that's really, these two witnesses saw that and then called the police, and they chased it and eventually caught it and dragged it off, and witnesses heard it screaming in a bag, and the military took it away.
And then a police officer somehow died in the process.
Right. So he was one of the ones that I think handled the bag or put it in the bag.
Well, and here maybe again another biological virus problem.
Yeah, I think that absolutely is. That's the very dangerous aspect, maybe not deliberate. If they wanted to kill you, that'd be a different matter. But...
True. Well, it sounds like there's a pattern here. If you see one, don't touch one.
That's right. Definitely, that's very true.
Go to the phones again, east of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast to Coast. You're with us. Hi.
Hello. My name is Roger. I live in Marble Hill, Missouri.
Now where's that, Roger?
It's about 35 miles east of Cape Girardeau.
Okay.
Okay. Hello, Ryan. Hello, George.
Uh-huh.
And I believe it or not, this is not common knowledge about this crash around Cape Girardeau. I only found out myself about 4 years ago on the History Channel.
You're kidding me.
No.
All these years you've been out there?
Right. I've asked older people I know and things. It's really not common knowledge. But anyway, when I did hear about it, I heard about the Reverend Huffman, and I knew some Huffmans that live here. And one of them I used to see at the coffee shop all the time, was pretty good friends with, and I made the mistake of asking him about it in front of some other people.
Ah. What happened?
He just didn't say anything.
He clamped up on you.
Yes. Well, about, I'd say a week later, I just happened to sit down at the table with him by himself. And he said, I do know all about that. He said, the Reverend Huffman was my great uncle.
Oh, my.
And I said, well, do you know where it crashed? And he said, I know exactly where it crashed. And I said, well, where was it? He said, well, I'll tell you sometime. And every month or so, I would ask him about that. And sadly, he passed away in sleep one night.
And he never showed you the spot, did he?
He never told me where it was at. But he does have a couple of sons that doesn't live here. I see them every once in a while, and I'm going to ask them if he ever told them about it.
Would you have gone to see the site?
Oh, yes,
yeah,
I would.
I
have seen two UFOs myself. In the 60s, 70s, and 80s, it was pretty commonplace to see UFOs in this area. I do have a question for both of you.
Sure thing. Go ahead.
In 1989, I was about 10 miles from Cape Girardeau on a back road, and we had a meteor shower. And my wife and I just stopped in the road a little ways from a house and watched the meteors. I mean, they was just coming by, and all of a sudden the sky lit up after the meteor shower, and there was a UFO. And it come within, I would say, 200 feet of our car, about 50 to 100 feet in the air, and just hovered there. And my wife actually almost tried to climb out of the car. And I had heard or read somewhere where somebody got a radiation burn from doing that.
That's so possible.
I stopped, right. I stopped her from doing that, and it moved a little ways right behind a house. And I backed up real quick and was pulling into the driveway of the house, and it just turned, did a 190, and took off, and within 30 seconds it was out of sight.
Did it have a lot of lights around it?
Yes. It was just like the drawings that you see on TV.
Sure, or like the movie Close Encounters of the Third
Correct.
Kind. Yeah.
Correct. But what my question is, have you got reports of UFOs with meteor showers? And I'll listen if you can hang up.
Okay, sir. Now, that's a pretty interesting question, Ryan, because sometimes they are in the vicinity of some of these celestial events. So what are the odds of a UFO being close by?
Well, you know, the odds are probably pretty good. You know, I think every night somewhere on the planet there's a visible UFO. And these meteor showers and showers occur, you know, periodically throughout the year, and you have to be lucky at the right time and right place to see it. Do they use it as cover? I think that they don't bother. They sort of
not anymore.
Yeah.
Plus, you know, in a lot of the movies you would see, when you'd see these tremendous cloud patterns developing, mm-hmm. with lights underneath them or behind them, a major size UFO would come out of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think there's any need for it. I mean, they can either cloak or uncloak. They can, you know, hide in clouds like they did on the History Channel in in the Mexico sightings that was reported last month on the History Channel, or not, where they zoom in and out of a helicopter formation in broad daylight. You know, different civilizations have different missions and different requirements and different agendas, and it's hard to tell. I'm fascinated. I would love to follow up with that guy and try to dig around and advance the Cape Girardeau case a little more.
It's got to be exciting and at the same time very scary to be within 50 feet or 100 feet of a craft like that, and you know it's not of this planet. If you know, it's got to be unbelievable. I've never seen one. I sure would like one. Hey, what about you, Ryan?
I've never seen a UFO. I've always been an analyst, interested in the phenomenon and taking an analyst viewpoint. And my father has never seen one either. He's been wanting to see one a long time. So we both come out of this mold of being intellectually curious about this phenomenon, this very important phenomenon.
All right, back to the more phone calls. Let's go to our wild card line. You're on with us. Hi there.
Hello, George.
Yeah.
Hi. Hi, Ryan.
Hi.
I have a question for your guest and a little story to tell you. George, I'd sent you an email a couple months ago about this. Perhaps you didn't get it. But I'm Mike from Ohio, by the way.
Okay.
And speaking to the back engineering aspect of it, Ryan, have you ever heard of or spoken to anybody who's ever seen a conventional military aircraft powered by some other force other than a jet engine?
No, but I've heard rumors that there's some helicopters that have anti-gravity control in them.
Okay. The reason I asked, George, this happened about 25 years ago. A friend of mine and I, it was in the autumn part of the year. It was at night, it was after 11 o'clock at night, but the sky was backlit from lights from the city, a nearby city. And we were standing talking, I heard a sound, just a rustling of leaves in the tree, in the top of this tree. And I thought, that's strange, there's no wind tonight or anything. And I looked up, and hovering right above the tree, about 25 feet, the tree was probably 20-some feet,
mm-hmm.
It was hovering right above this tree. It was a Harrier, an AV-8 Harrier, and I know it was a Harrier. I recognized the silhouette.
What was it doing there?
It was just hovering. We didn't know it was there at all.
But why would it be there?
I don't know. This is really bizarre. It happened here in Ohio. This was like 25 years ago, and it was just hovering there. And the only way that we detected it was I noticed I heard this rustling of leaves. And it was the only the leaves in the tree, just in this one tree, were just moving like in a breeze, but there was no wind, and it was just the leaves in the top of the tree moving. And that's when I saw the Harrier. And he just hovered there for like maybe a minute or half a minute, and then he started to move off. And as he did, I had the presence to look at the cockpit through the canopy, and I could see a helmet. It looked like he was looking at us, and then he turned his head in the direction that he was moving. And I strained to hear anything at all. And all you could hear is a slight whistling sound, very, very faint, but you would never hear it unless you were listening for it, straining for it. And I think it was just the air moving across the fuselage and the wings. And when he got about maybe 50 yards away, he turned on his night position lights. I'm a pilot, so I know what they look like. They were standard position lights. Then he turned on his landing light. It was brilliant. It lit up the trees in front of him. It lit up part of the ground underneath him. And he moved slowly, probably 20 knots, moved away at 20 knots, never picked up speed, never gained altitude, and we just watched him until he was out
strange.
Of sight.
Well, you know, the first Harrier was made in 1971, so it very well was one of those.
Well, but, you know, being in the military, I was in air defense artillery. And at the time, they didn't have some of the more modern weapons like Stinger that could recognize friend from foe. So back then, we had to be able to identify by silhouette only all aircraft in NATO and the Warsaw Pact. And I was stationed in Europe. I've been very close to Harriers before.
Well, if you weren't in the military and had the knowledge of what they look like, if you were just a civilian, could you have confused that with a UFO, do you think? Do you think some people have?
I don't know. To me, it was plain. The person that was with me didn't have a clue as to what it was, but I knew exactly the shape of a Harrier. They're very
sure.
distinct, but yeah.
Would that person have thought it was extraterrestrial?
That's a possibility. It could have been mistaken for that.
Yeah.
But, I've been close to Harriers before. Not that close, because they use the Rolls-Royce Pegasus engine, which is, like, notoriously loud and ear-splitting.
Oh, that'll blow your ears out.
And we were 25 feet from this tree, and the tree was maybe max 25 feet high, and it was right over top of this.
Okay, well, thank you. Where'd you go? You still there? You still there?
Off of that tree,
yeah.
If it was a jet engine.
Okay, well, thanks. I appreciate you. It's not a UFO, but it's an interesting story. Next up, let's go to our wild card line. You're on the air with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Tom from Seattle.
Hi, Tom. Go ahead, sir.
Hi, I'm presently calling from Chula Vista, California, listening to you on KOGO San Diego.
Absolutely. Our number one station in San Diego.
You got it. Okay, I tuned in just at the tail end, the last hour, and during the break, I thought, well, I'll try to give a call, and I am in. And comes to find out when you introduced Ryan that his expertise is perhaps a little bit different from what I wish to relate, but I think it's interesting enough to relate anyhow.
Can you do it in a minute?
I can do it, yes.
Go.
Okay, in 64 or 65, when I was in the Navy, I was on the aircraft carrier Ranger. We were on station off the coast of Vietnam. And I worked in the operations office, so I was pretty well aware of what was going on around the ship. And all at once, we got the real super secret activity. And come to find out, the destroyers around us identified an object that they could not identify underneath of the carrier.
Underneath it.
Yes, underneath. And it just followed the ship wherever we went. We tried evasive movements and going fast and coming to a dead stop. And during those days, I guess they didn't have quite the capability of detecting things as today, or at least identifying them. And the operations officer and the captain, the XO, was really quiet about this. But via the intelligence people and communications people, I knew I got some information. But nobody can identify this, and I understood that our government worked through State Department with other governments to see if anyone had a submarine in the area, and everything came up negative. They didn't know what it was, and then about the third or fourth day, whatever it was, it just disappeared as quickly as it appeared.
Well, after listening to a show like this, Ryan, I think we know what it was. Ryan, we're out of time. Thanks. Great work with the book. And let's make sure everyone has a chance to go to Amazon.com or your website, which is linked on coasttocoastam.com. Thanks, Ryan.
Thanks so much, George.
Appreciate you being on the show. For Nikki Imbrononi, Steve Carr, Dan Galanti, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.